The bell connects to land, the room is on the sea. The promise that they hold is joint prosperity.
We're breaking barriers, we're making history. The world we're dreaming of starts with you and me.
And that sweet little children's jingle emanates from the big media outlet, the China Daily, personalising, you could say, China's new Silk Road, or the One Belt, One Road strategy, OBOR, get used to the name, possibly the world's most ambitious current project. China wants to use these ancient trading routes and more and plough hundreds of billions of dollars into infrastructure along the way. New ports, roads, new rail networks that stretch from Western Europe, Africa and Southeast Asia into China. Now, world leaders and trade ministers have beaten a path to Beijing this week, and journalists, including our own Fran Kelly, to hear the full extent of China's vision, which many view as part of its long-term play for regional dominance. The question is, does Australia have a formal, settled view on these developments? Well, our former ambassador Jeff Raby, now a private consultant and regular contributor to Saturday Extra, suggests the answer is no, and he joined me earlier to tell me why this concerns him.
Good morning, Geraldine.
Before we focus on your particular critique, could you characterise this big new development plan, please, and the presentation made by President Xi Jinping?
Yeah, sure, Geraldine. I think we need to be clear the substance of it, building transport infrastructure networks from China along the Silk Road's traditional, but across Eurasia, building and developing port infrastructure around the Indian Ocean and elsewhere in Africa, and pipelines across China to the Indian Ocean. This infrastructure development is not new. It predates the concept of the One Belt, One Road or the New Silk Road. And it reflects a major set of considerations. One is how to recycle foreign exchange reserves, how to find a vent for China's massive infrastructure building capacity, and three, to provide alternatives for critical resources and energy supplies going to China without having to go all of it through the South China Sea or the Straits of Malacca. But since Xi Jinping became president, over the past 3 years, he has elevated what is a very practical set of policies into, I describe it as his grand vision and the grand narrative for Chinese foreign policy.
Well, it has also been compared to a new Marshall Plan, except much bigger, that amazing United States post-World War II development of war-ravaged nations in Europe, which really set up the peace, some would argue, that we've been fortunate enough to experience. So is it a soft power exercise like that?
Not really soft power. Maybe China would like it to be soft power, but in many ways it's been a little bit counterproductive in some places. China's behaviour has caused resistance in the local communities. Some of the neighbours, for example, Burma, Thailand, have been very reluctant to embrace this because China seemed to be overweening with it. But generally, it is about building relations and it is about Chinese influence and it's about China his role in reshaping the international order.
Yes. Now, I noticed that President Putin and President Erdogan from Turkey were there applauding from the front row. So they've made up their mind about it. Central to your article this week in the Financial Review was a critique. You say that Canberra continues to tie itself in knots over how to respond, as it did with the AIIB, the Asian Investment Bank. What's the problem here, in your view?
Well, I think the problem is that on China's side, the problem is that China is not very clear and transparent about its strategic objectives. And so that easily leads to people being suspicious, and Canberra has been suspicious. But also there's quite a big influence over Canberra's security and strategic thinking in Canberra from United States neoconservative think tanks who are on the basis of values, profoundly concerned about the rise of China and its influence in the world.
Are you sure of this, or is this just your guess?
I've been around long enough to know.
So you have evidence that you think that they have a disproportionate influence in the development of our policies and something as important as this?
Oh, well, when you see foreign policy Australia being positioned around values rather than interests, then that clearly is a strong indication that W's approach to foreign policy is prevailing. whereas, you know, countries have interests and permanent interests, but you know, values change as societies change and the world moves on. So it's not really a sound basis for foreign policy.
Now, our Trade Minister, Steve Chobo, was there.
Yes, he went briefly, but he didn't stay for the, you know, formal welcome dinner. It was a very abbreviated visit. You know, it's another example, like with the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, that we're not sure where we stand.
And do you think, did you say the Chinese noticed these things?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're so protocol conscious and so focused on symbols and reading symbols that everything people do like that at the ministerial level, very carefully calibrated and very carefully understood. And I think we were doing the same. We were sending a message. We're not actually in any way signed up to One Belt, One Road.
Now, I noticed that Paul Dibb, writing in The Australian this week, the Emeritus Professor of Strategy at the ANU and a very long-term commentator, is warning along these lines about not signing up too definitely. I am suggesting we need to be sceptical about China's motives and to proceed with great caution until we gain a better understanding of its geostrategic implications.
Well, like with the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, we missed the opportunity to be the founding developed country member to get a vice president's position, which the UK got because it was the first developed country to become a founding member. And we ended up joining after Luxembourg and before Norway, hardly big players in Asia Pacific. I mean, when we talk about signing up to the One Belt, One Road, we're not actually signing a treaty. We're not handing over any sovereignty. This is how China's going to structure and order its foreign policy and its outward investment policy. We can say no to any initiative, or we can influence initiative. And I would say, as for the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, if we have any doubts, if we have any suspicion, we're better off being involved to shape it and influence in our interests and not be ambivalent standing on the sidelines.
And you don't think there'd be any sort of collateral damage with our existing alliance partners? Dennis Richardson, the outgoing head of defence, said, "I'm in no doubt. We have friends in both camps, the US and China, but we are an alliance. We are allies with one, namely United States."
Yeah, well, I don't see how in any way it contradicts our alliance obligations. In fact, the United States sent a delegation to the Conference of States the whole time. What we have to understand is that foreign policy ultimately ends up being based on interests. And great powers, particularly I think the United States under Trump, will pursue an interest-based foreign policy. We have our own interests, and we need to be very clear about those interests and set about prosecuting them in our own interests. And part of that is maintaining the US alliance. But the US alliance doesn't exclude all of these other things in no way.
Geoff Raby, thank you very much indeed for those insights.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Geoff Raby, a chairman and CEO of Geoff Raby & Associates, a former Australian ambassador to China. And can I advise you that tomorrow on Sunday Extra, they're going to take this a little further by looking at the huge inroads China is making in Europe, particularly on the economic front, as state-owned enterprises and funds buy up tech companies and major transport infrastructure. So there's a big outreach underway.